Jaime's a man who arrives in San Francisco the day before the 1906 earthquake. Talk about timing. But has such a good ear, he can tell the difference between Cantonese and Mandarin Chinese, although he wasn't a speaker of either language.
Absolutely, yeah. And he stayed for a while in San Francisco at a kind of rooming house that was full of Spaniards, some Italians, and then what were called Turks, which could be anybody from a Greek to a Lebanese to a Syrian. And he, from early on, I mean, really as a teenager, had a very good ear, and he could tell the different dialects of Spain. He could tell who was, Castilian and Catalan, but much more than that, he knew who came from Grenada or Andalusia or around Barcelona, who might be Basque, and he could also pick up the songs very quickly. And late in life, he became a real scholar of different Spanish songs, and that set him up for his translations of García Lorca.
One of the things you said last night in talking about bioregionalism and, one of the great tragedies of losing these languages, and especially as we look at the situation we're now, the sixth great, crisis, species crisis, an ecological crisis unprecedented in world history, is that, in your words, indigenous languages are user manuals for bioregions. So maybe you could elaborate on that and give us a context of his work in saving these native California languages and some sense of how connected to the land and illustrate that indigenous languages are user manuals for bioregions.
Sure, yeah. I think that it's clear that indigenous languages all around the world have had a long time to settle into particular bioregions and embedded in not just the vocabulary, I'm pretty sure, but maybe in morphology and syntax and grammar, there are specifics about the bioregion. Very simply, most indigenous languages tend to have place names that are based on ecological relationships or maybe historic events. Settler place names tend to be real estate, named for people who either found them or claimed them or homesteaded them or bought them or platted them out and sold them off or something like that. The best example I pulled out of Angulo's work is his work with the Karok and Yurok Indians up around sort of Eureka and Arcata in California, sort of Trinity River country and that, Trinity Alps. The Karok people, as he says, live in a world of rivers and ridges. It's a tightly wound landscape of steep hills and winding rivers, really steep mountains and winding rivers, and villages tended to be on these sort of alluvial plains or the river bends where there's a little bit of flat land, and the steep, very difficult hills are used for hunting. And their directions are all upriver, downriver, upridge, downridge. And Karok means in their language upriver. And so they are the upriver people, and the Yurok means downriver, and they are the downriver people. So that would be one example of a language that fits itself to a landscape. And as he said, it's not as though they couldn't understand east, south, north, and west. And they certainly recognize those and use those when necessary, but the exigencies of their landscapes didn't really need to take so much account of the cardinal directions as things like where, what direction do you go? Upriver, downriver, upridge, downridge.
As we have here with the ish suffix, meaning the people of any particular watershed, Duwam-ish, Suquam-ish, Snohomish, and what have you.
Yeah, and so Angulo really saw that, old ways of interacting with the landscape and we're interacting with the animals, the plants, the weather patterns, the geographical features were deeply embedded in languages. And when the languages started to disappear, you ended up with, as I said, those sort of overlays that are almost nonsensical, the prairie dog, or the pronghorn antelope, things like that. And, really misnomers, and especially people who've not often had the time to settle in long enough to learn the habits and, the migration patterns, the personalities of the animals and birds and fish, let alone the plant life.
Right, which is what you get a sense of when you read Gary Snyder's, what is it, The Least You Should Know as a Poet, that poem that he... That's
oh, what you need to know to be a poet.
What you need to know to be a poet, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Snyder also credited Dan Gulo's influence in his essay, The Incredible Survival of Coyote. And him going to Colorado and he gets to hear coyotes for the first time is an amazing thing in his life, I could imagine. And then there are great coyote stories that he gathered. In fact, you've told one, what was it, Thursday night, about during Prohibition.
Oh, going yeah. Yeah.
That's a good story. I would love to hear that.
Sure. Before I do that, I'll read one paragraph from a letter of his that's a fantastic description of the first time he writes about the coyote. This is a letter home that he writes to his parents, and you have to think of him as a boy who grew up in the sort of a cloistered Catholic family in the best neighborhood of Paris, and he had really probably never had any experience of anything much wilder than a pigeon. And when he ended up ranching in western central Colorado, really, around Carbondale,
And he's a nighthawk at this time. He has to stay up all night and make sure the cattle don't escape at night.
Yeah, the nighthawk is a very lonely and dangerous occupation. It's sort of being the guy who rides around on horseback at night, keeping the cattle calm, making sure predators don't get at them. And if a cow or bull runs off, you have to go thundering through the darkness over the sagebrush after the animal. And so it was dangerous and lonely. And most of the nighthawks spent the night singing to themselves to stay warm and to stay awake. And then he writes home. I say, he made particular note of an animal he would later write of with great intimacy, which would become closely identified with him in the lore of the American West, the coyote. This is what he writes. The wind blows softly in the grass. From far away, you hear the voice of the night wrangler singing to his horses to calm them and keep them together. From time to time, you hear the cry of a coyote. Nothing is as horrible, as dismal, as the cry of a coyote. First, there is a sort of raucous bark which extends into a long, sharp scream and finishes with a sob. You think of an old woman crying. When you hear that dismal sob in the dark night, you can't help but shiver. I think that's a great description of it. And I still am, you know, awfully amused when somebody says, Listen, there must be 30 coyote out there, and it's actually probably 2 coyote. You know, they have this incredible way of, you know, ventriloquizing and creating, you know, multiple sounds. Not really cries, but whimpers, barks, howls, yelps, caterwauls. It's an amazing range that they have.
And you live in coyote country now. So.
I do, yeah. So the story you want to know about, this is from 1920s. Jaime and Nancy were at the Berkeley House. They often had guests there, Indian friends who they worked with, who would stay for months and months at a time. And they had Indians staying with them. And Nancy wanted to go off to Jamestown from Berkeley. Jamestown is getting over towards the Sierra Nevada. She had a Sierra Miwok friend. An Indian named Killelly Joe, who had a bit of a reputation. He was one of the first Native American football players. And Nancy and he were quite close, and she wanted to do some work with him. So she and Jaime decided to take a trip out there, and their Indian friend got in the car with them, and they drove across the state. And as they got towards Jamestown, it began to get dark. And their companion said, "Anybody want a drink?" And he directed Jaime up a side road, and they went up an elevation a bit into the forests. And after a couple of miles, they saw oil lamps in the windows of an old clapboard building. It was a little speakeasy. And they went in to get a drink. Jaime was at the bar, and he started talking to a Sierra Miwok guy. And he said to him, how do your people say the world was made? And the guy said, well, it's like this. Coyote was on the hillside and he had to take a piss. And I said, wait a minute. Hang on. I was just talking with a Pitt River woman the other day, and they say Silver Fox made the world. The guy shrugs and says, they say Silver Fox, we say Coyote. Anyhow, Coyote was on the hillside, he had to take piss, and he turned to where the ocean was going to be because he didn't want to drown anybody. Hang on, said Jaime. How could he be afraid of drowning anybody if the world hasn't been made yet? And I gave him a little smile and said, you know, when I was a boy, we're living up near Susanville. I remember my dad was sitting out in the front yard on a stump and he was whittling down a fence post with an axe handle. And I went up to him and I said, Dad, you know, that story, how could Coyote be afraid of drowning somebody if there weren't any people yet? And you know, my old man said to me, son, when I was a boy, I wondered that too.
Oh, shit.